In the last lecture, we talked about Einstein's work in the area of cosmology. For a combination of personal and philosophical reasons, Einstein felt that the overall structure of the universe had to be static and unchanging with time. But his gravitational field equations didn't allow for such a universe. Instead, the cosmological solutions to these equations featured a universe that was inevitably either expanding or contracting with time. In an effort to evade this conclusion and to force the universe to remain static, Einstein introduced an entirely new term into the field equations, a term that contained what he called the cosmological constant. This term could push back against the tendency of the universe to contract, striking a balance between expansion and contraction. But this balance was a precarious one. And other scientists quickly and correctly pointed out that Einstein's proposed configuration wasn't stable. Although Einstein himself did not yet agree, the mathematics of Einstein's theory was clear and insistent that the universe must change with time. In 1929, 12 years after Einstein's paper on cosmology, Edwin Hubble discovered that our universe is in fact expanding. And a couple of years after that, Einstein finally conceded the argument, accepting that our universe is not static, but instead changes with time. He is said to have called this the biggest blunder he ever made in his life. When the dust had finally settled, it became clear that the universe is expanding. There seemed to be no need for Einstein's cosmological constant. But this is not exactly how cosmologists see things today. Modern cosmologists, including myself, are still in uniform agreement that our universe is expanding. And we're confident that our universe has expanded over the past 13.8 billion years or so from a very hot and dense state to form the universe that we see around us today. That much is not really in question. But starting in the 1990s, we learned that our universe is not only expanding, but that it's expanding at a faster and faster rate. This accelerated rate of expansion is not easy to explain or understand within the context of Einstein's gravitational field equations. In fact, the easiest way to explain the surprising behavior is to reintroduce the long-abandoned cosmological constant. But whereas this cosmological constant was originally introduced by Einstein to hold the universe still, in its modern form, it instead acts to drive the universe apart, causing it to expand more and more rapidly as time passes. This lecture is going to be about the role of Einstein's cosmological constant within the context of modern cosmology. But before we get to that, there's a lot about cosmology that we need to cover first. So let's pick up where we left off last time. Hubble had just demonstrated that our universe is expanding. But what does this mean about our universe? And what does it imply about our universe's past and its future? Over the decades that followed Hubble's discovery, physicists and astronomers began to contemplate the implications of this result. Although a number of different interpretations were proposed and considered, the most important of these interpretations was the foundation of what would later be known as the Big Bang Theory. Let me explain how Hubble's observation that the universe is expanding connects to the idea of the Big Bang. As our universe expands, its density of matter and energy is steadily diluted. This means that the density of our universe was higher in the past than it is today. And in the future, the density of our universe will be lower than it is now. Given that the total amount of stuff in our universe doesn't change with time, the density of that stuff has to go down as the universe expands. In addition to diluting the density of matter and energy in the universe, the expansion of space also has the effect of cooling the matter and energy that is present. If you take some ordinary stuff, like a gas of atoms or maybe some photons of light, and you compress that stuff into a small volume of space, you'll find that it heats up. Well, this means that our universe was not only much smaller in the past, but also much hotter. And in the future, the universe will be a much colder place than it is today. If you follow this logic backwards through time, you can start to reconstruct some of the events that took place over the course of our universe's history. From the current expansion rate and average density of our universe, we can calculate the expansion history of our universe. In other words, we can calculate how big a given piece of our universe was at any given point in the past or future. From this calculation, we learn that a few billion years ago, the universe was about half of its current size. And over the past 10 billion years, it has expanded by more than a factor of 100. And as you go back farther in time, the universe gets smaller and hotter. If you go back far enough, about 13.8 billion years into the past, you'll reach a point at which the universe was infinitely dense and infinitely hot. This is what is known as the Big Bang. Modern cosmologists are uniformly confident that our universe emerged and expanded from such a hot and dense state. Among scientists today, the Big Bang is not controversial. It's clearly established fact. But throughout most of the 20th century, this wasn't yet the case. To most scientists, it wasn't at all clear what the best way to interpret Hubble's discovery was. And there were ideas other than the Big Bang theory that offered competing visions for our universe's evolution and history. In the decades that followed Hubble's discovery, it wasn't at all clear which of these ideas, if any, would turn out to be correct. To many scientists, they all seemed kind of crazy. And at the time, there weren't any observations or measurements that were able to distinguish between them. But as time went on, this began to change. Cosmologists began to propose and explore ways in which the Big Bang theory and its competitors could be tested. In particular, advocates of the Big Bang theory started to argue that many of the atomic nuclei found in our universe were likely forged in the heat of the Big Bang. If that was true, then it might be possible to calculate the quantities of different chemical elements that should have been formed in the Big Bang and compare these to the abundances found in our actual universe. Most scientists at the time did not think that our universe's atomic nuclei were formed in the Big Bang. Instead, the leading view was that they had been formed in stars through the process of nuclear fusion. This was an entirely reasonable hypothesis at the time, and in fact, some nuclei are formed in stars. The Sun, for example, gets its energy by fusing hydrogen nuclei together to form helium. And by 1940 or so, astrophysicists had figured out most of the basic nuclear processes that are at work within stars. To most scientists at the time, the idea that all of our universe's nuclei were formed in stars looked like a pretty good bet. But in the late 1940s, a few cosmologists started to challenge this idea. In papers written in 1946 and 1948, George Gamow and Ralph Alpher suggested that instead of being formed in stars, most of the atomic nuclei may have been formed through nuclear fusion that had taken place in the first few minutes after the Big Bang. After all, in these first few minutes, the entire universe was as hot and as dense as the core of a star, precisely the kinds of conditions that lead to the fusion of lighter nuclei into heavier ones. For years, a debate ensued between the supporters of these two theories, the theory of stellar nucleosynthesis and that of the Big Bang nucleosynthesis. But as it turns out, the resolution to this debate was not as simple as either side imagined. Neither of these two theories could explain all of the atomic nuclei that are found in our universe. By the late 1950s, it had become pretty clear that stars alone could not have formed all of the helium that is found throughout our universe. And as Gamow and Alpher's calculations were improved and refined, cosmologists became increasingly convinced that the Big Bang could not have been responsible for many of the heavier types of nuclei. The Big Bang could have generated the lighter elements like deuterium, lithium, helium, and beryllium, but nothing much heavier. So what was the resolution to this messy situation? Well, both groups were wrong, and they were also both right. The advocates of stellar nucleosynthesis were right that many nuclei are formed in stars. All of the heavier nuclei, including everything from boron, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, up to stuff like gold, silver, and uranium, all of that was made in stars. And stars have made some of the lighter nuclei as well. But the vast majority of the lighter nuclei, the deuterium and helium in particular, were instead formed in the first few minutes after the Big Bang. In hindsight, we can see that this was the right answer. But that being said, this was not at all a consensus view at the time. Most physicists and astrophysicists in the 1950s still didn't think that the Big Bang was real. But they didn't necessarily like the alternative theories either. Overall, they were pretty skeptical of anything that cosmologists were saying across the board. At the time, cosmology wasn't a particularly respectable branch of science yet. It seemed messy and complicated, and research into it wasn't very well funded. To most scientists, it was hard to know how to interpret the different observations and arguments that were being made. Things did start to get more clear as time progressed, however. Probably more than any other single event, it was the discovery of something called the cosmic microwave background that ultimately established the Big Bang theory as the mainstream consensus view of the scientific community. The cosmologists who had done the calculations for Big Bang nucleosynthesis knew that if the Big Bang were to generate the right amounts of helium and other light nuclei, then there must have been an era in the early history of our universe in which light and not matter made up most of the energy. This era corresponds to the first 100,000 years after the Big Bang or so. As the universe expanded, this light was steadily diluted, and it became steadily cooler. Today, this light still exists. The whole universe is filled with it. But it contains so little energy that we barely notice it. This light takes the form of microwaves. It's a fossil of our distant past. It's everywhere and it's all around us. In 1964, two radio astronomers working for Bell Labs, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, detected this cosmic microwave background for the first time. They had been pointing a radio antenna away from the Earth, trying to use it as a telescope. But no matter where they pointed it, they always got a frustrating hum of background radiation, like a steady hiss of static on your radio. They tried everything to make this background go away, but it just wouldn't. They didn't know it at the time, but they discovered a sea of photons that fills the entire universe and surrounds us all. These photons have been traveling for billions of years, since the early history of our universe. In the years that followed, other astronomers measured the cosmic microwave background at a variety of different frequencies and with ever greater precision. These measurements left little room for debate. In particular, these observations definitively showed that our universe had once been very hot. Our universe did, in fact, emerge and expand from a state known as the Big Bang. With the discovery of the cosmic microwave background, the Big Bang theory became the consensus view of the scientific mainstream. And as time went on, other measurements and observations were made, which served to strengthen this case. By the time that I started studying physics in the late 1990s, virtually all scientists agreed that our universe had, in fact, expanded over billions of years from a hot and ultra-dense state. During this period of time, the late 1990s, new and important cosmological observations were being carried out. It was hoped that these observations would considerably refine our understanding of the universe and how it had expanded over its history. Among other open questions, it still wasn't clear whether the geometry of our universe was positively curved, negatively curved, or flat. You may recall from the last lecture the differences between universes with these three types of geometry. In a positively curved space, parallel lines gradually converge toward one another. A universe that is positively curved is analogous to the surface of a sphere. It is possible, for example, that the size of a positively curved universe could be finite, like the surface area of the Earth is. We call a universe like this a closed universe. And then there is the opposite possibility, a universe with negative curvature. In a negatively curved space, parallel lines diverge away from one another. We call a universe like this an open universe. And last but not least, it was possible that our universe might be spatially flat. In a flat universe, the geometry is neither positively nor negatively curved across large distances. In a flat universe, good old high school geometry works just fine. In cosmology, it turns out that geometry also has a lot to do with the future and fate of a universe. The expansion rate of a universe that's closed, for example, will gradually slow down and stop at some future point. After it stops expanding, it will start to contract until it ultimately undergoes something like a Big Bang in reverse, what we call a Big Crunch. On the other hand, if a universe is open, then it will expand forever, The expansion rate of such a universe will gradually slow down, but it will never stop, and will never reverse. And lastly, a flat universe lives on the boundary between the open and closed cases. Its expansion rate slows down as it gradually approaches an asymptotic maximum size. In the 1990s, cosmologists were determined to find out which of these three kinds of universe we were living in. Is our universe closed and positively curved, open and negatively curved, or flat? To do this, they had to better measure the expansion rate of our universe at multiple times over the course of its history. When Edwin Hubble made his famous measurement that demonstrated that our universe is expanding, he did it using Cepheid variable stars. Because of a known relationship that existed between the luminosities of these stars and the rates of their pulsations, it was possible for astronomers such as Hubble to deduce how far away from us a given Cepheid was. But Cepheid stars aren't really all that bright, and we can only detect them in the local corner of our universe, within the Milky Way and in other nearby galaxies. What cosmologists needed in the 1990s was something that they could use in the same way that Hubble had once used Cepheid stars, but they had to be much brighter than Cepheids. To accomplish this, modern cosmologists make use of a kind of exploding star known as a Type 1a supernova. A Type 1a supernova is an event that is triggered when a white dwarf star pulls off enough material from a nearby star, causing the white dwarf to collapse and explode as a supernova. The thing that makes this particular kind of supernova so useful to cosmologists is that they always explode when their mass exceeds the same particular threshold. This means that these explosions always have more or less the same brightness. So in the 1990s, cosmologists started to use these supernovae to do the same thing that Hubble had done in the 1920s with Cepheid stars. But compared to Cepheids, Type 1a supernovae are much, much brighter and can be observed at much greater distances. Using Cepheids, one can measure our universe's current rate of expansion. But with Type 1a supernovae, one can map out the expansion history of our universe over billions of years of its history. In 1998, two separate groups of cosmologists announced the results of their observations of dozens of different Type 1a supernovae. It was widely anticipated that these groups would be able to finally tell us whether the geometry of our universe was open, closed, or flat. But when the results came in, they didn't look like any of the expected answers. From among the expected options, nature had chosen none of the above. In all three of the expected scenarios, open, closed, or flat, the expansion rate of our universe was predicted to be slowing down. But from their observations of these Type 1a supernovae, cosmologists had learned that our universe is not only expanding, but it's expanding at an accelerating rate. By this, I mean that our universe is expanding faster today than it was a few billion years ago. To understand the implications of this, let's consider an analogy. Imagine that I have a big cannon that fires baseballs straight upwards from the Earth's surface. If a given baseball leaves the cannon at a speed of less than about 25,000 miles per hour, the baseball will fly upward for a while until it finally stops, reverses direction, and then falls back towards the Earth. This is like the expansion history of a closed universe. A closed universe will expand for a while until it slows down, stops, reverses, and ends in a big crunch. Next, let's imagine that the cannon launches a baseball at a greater speed, more than 25,000 miles per hour. Once again, in this case, the baseball slows down because of the pull of gravity, but it never comes to a halt. In this case, the baseball has enough kinetic energy to escape the pull of Earth's gravity, allowing it to fly off into space forever. Even in this case, however, the baseball is always slowing down. This case is analogous to the expansion history of an open universe, which expands forever, but that also slows down as time goes on. Before the observations of the Type 1a supernovae, cosmologists had expected our universe to behave like a baseball does in this analogy. They had hoped that their measurements would tell them whether the baseball would eventually stop and fall back to Earth, or would instead fly off into space forever. In either case, they expected that the universe's expansion rate would be slowing down with time. But instead, these observations revealed that the expansion rate is speeding up, expanding faster and faster, when we had expected gravity to be slowing it down. They discovered that something is actively propelling the expansion rate of our universe. Something is acting against the force of gravity and pulling our universe apart. From within the context of general relativity and Einstein's field equations, there's only one way to explain how a universe might be able to expand at an accelerating rate. For any universe that contains only matter, its expansion rate will slow down with time, just like any baseball's velocity will always slow down as it moves away from the Earth. To make the expansion rate speed up or accelerate with time, you really have no other option but to include Einstein's long-abandoned cosmological constant. In fact, the most recent cosmological observations, including those of Type 1a supernovae and the cosmic microwave background, find that only about 30% of the total energy in our universe consists of matter. This 30% includes all the different kinds of atoms and molecules, as well as other substances known as dark matter. The remaining 70% of all of the energy in the universe is instead stored up in Einstein's cosmological constant. Modern cosmologists refer to this energy as dark energy. So in a sense, perhaps we can see this as a kind of vindication for Einstein. It has been said that Einstein once called the inclusion of the cosmological constant his biggest blunder. But almost 70 years later, it turns out that this kind of term is needed to describe our universe after all. Unlike the cosmological constant that Einstein originally imagined, however, this one does not hold our universe steady and static. Instead, it actively pushes outward, causing space to grow at a faster and faster rate. So far in these lectures, I've been talking about Einstein's cosmological constant only as a mathematical construct. I've described its effects on the expansion history of the universe, but I haven't really talked about what the term might mean or what it physically represents. Physically speaking, the presence of the cosmological constant represents a uniform and unchanging density of energy, which we call dark energy. This dark energy is found everywhere and uniformly throughout the universe. This means that everywhere in our universe there is a background of dark energy. This is in addition to any energy that might be found in the form of matter or light or anything else. Because of the cosmological constant, empty space itself contains a fixed density of dark energy. Generally speaking, the effects of dark energy are very subtle and we don't notice it very easily. Within the entire volume of the Earth, for example, the total amount of dark energy is equivalent of only a few milligrams of mass. This is not enough to make any appreciable impact on any experiment we might try to conduct. But the Earth is not a typical place in the universe. The vast majority of the universe's volume is nearly empty, with very low densities of matter and other energy. This means that on very large scales, cosmological scales, the dark energy is much more important and can have a significant impact on our universe and its rate of expansion. On average, there is more energy in the form of dark energy than in everything else found in our universe put together. To me, the strangest thing about dark energy is that it cannot be diluted. This background of dark energy has the same density in our universe today that it had billions of years ago. This is very different from other ordinary forms of matter or energy. If I had a kilogram of gas in a cubic meter of space, and then I expanded that space from 1 to 2 cubic meters, the density of the gas would decline from 1 kilogram per cubic meter to 0.5 kilograms per cubic meter. The expansion of space dilutes the density of matter and other ordinary substances, but not dark energy. As the universe expands, the density of dark energy remains fixed. At around this point in the lecture, I would have liked to explain to you what exactly dark energy is, or to explain why it is that even empty space contains a fixed density of energy. The fact is, however, that we don't really have answers to these questions, or at least not very complete answers. On the one hand, what we have learned about physics over the past century makes it easy for us to imagine ways in which empty space might come to contain energy. On some atomic scales, our universe is governed by the laws of quantum physics. Among other things, these laws say that it is possible for energy and matter to be spontaneously created, albeit only for very short periods of time. From this perspective, it seems very plausible that the observed dark energy might be nothing more than vast numbers of quantum particles spontaneously coming into and out of existence throughout our entire universe. But when we look more closely at this idea, we run into problems. When we carry out the kinds of calculations that are involved in determining the energy density of empty space, we find that the energy density that should be generated in this way is much, much larger than the density observed by cosmologists. And if we're honest, we have to admit that we really don't understand what is going on here. Since dark energy was discovered in the 1990s, thousands of papers have been published in scientific journals attempting to address some facet of this problem. And still, I'm not sure we're any closer to solving this puzzle. Despite all this effort, the nature of dark energy remains arguably the biggest mystery in all of physics today. But even if we don't understand it, dark energy still exhibits a strong influence over our universe and its expansion rate. More than anything else, the existence of dark energy has incredible implications for the far future of our universe. As time goes on, the density of matter is diluted by the steady expansion of space. This means that as time advances, dark energy gradually makes up a larger and larger fraction of the total energy in our universe. Today, about 70% of all energy is in the form of dark energy. In the future, this number will become higher and higher. And as dark energy comes to increasingly dominate the total energy of our universe, it will drive space to expand faster and faster. A couple of trillion years from now, our universe will be expanding so fast that we will only be able to see the nearest handful of galaxies. The amount of space between us and the other galaxies will be expanding so fast that light from them to us will never be able to reach us, even traveling at the speed of light. In this lecture, I talked about the modern evidence for the cosmological constant within the gravitational field equations of general relativity. Einstein originally proposed this term in order to balance the forces of expansion and contraction in an effort to allow our universe to be static and unchanging. He then abandoned this term when Edwin Hubble's observation convinced him that our universe is in fact expanding. In recent decades, cosmologists have discovered that our universe is not only expanding, but is expanding at a steadily accelerating rate. To explain this unexpected behavior, we've been forced to reintroduce Einstein's cosmological constant, renaming it dark energy. Although there is a great deal we do not understand about dark energy, its impact on our universe and its history is abundantly evident. Physicists sometimes debate whether the discovery of dark energy should be seen as a vindication of Einstein. Personally, I can see both sides of this argument. On the one hand, Einstein was apparently right that such a term could exist, and in fact, does exist. But Einstein's version of the cosmological constant played a very different role in our universe than dark energy does. Perhaps we can all agree that a partial vindication is in order.